Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today we're embarking on, well, a bit of an architectural and economic journey. We're cracking open decades of really focused research on one crucial question. How do you build urban centers that are not just desirable places to live, but are, you know, economically self-sustaining? We're diving into the work of Nicholas Falk and the late Professor Sir Peter Hall, tracing their arguments from the late 2000s right up to their most recent thinking on creating the ultimate social city.
That's right. And for years, they systematically analyzed why the UK consistently struggled with large-scale strategic planning. I mean, especially around housing, economic growth, and the creation of these big new settlements, especially when you compare it to its European peers. Our mission today is to take that stack of sources you provided, particularly the framework from their really influential 2009 article, Why Not Here, and just map out the steps, the financial, the strategic, the political steps required to actually build these ambitious places successfully.
And that initial diagnosis, the one based on those early study tours, it was incredibly telling, wasn't it?
Oh, absolutely.
It immediately pointed out that the UK was lagging, and I'm quoting here, far behind its continental rivals.
Mm-hmm.
We saw this minimal, really slow progress with projects like the English ecotowns, while Europe was just successfully delivering these massive functional urban extensions at scale.
Exactly. The problem wasn't a lack of good ideas. It was a failure of implementation. They kept asking, why weren't solutions that worked perfectly well just across the channel being implemented here? And that prompted them to sort of evolve the fundamental blueprint. We often hear references to Ebenezer Howard's original Garden City idea, you know, a cluster of green, healthy settlements. But while those core values are still vital, Falk and Hall recognize the modern requirement is for a dense, highly connected, job-generating model. The model they termed the Continental Compact City.
That distinction is so key. I mean, Howard's original vision from his 1898 pamphlet, Tomorrow, A Peaceful Path to Real Reform, it was revolutionary for its time. But the modern world needs scale and connectivity that perhaps a strict Garden City just couldn't deliver. So the Continental Compact City is essentially, it's denser, it's better connected, and it's more focused on maximizing economic efficiency alongside livability.
Precisely. It's all about leveraging proximity, but you can't achieve that if the structural foundation is weak. Their 2009 research, it went way beyond just lamenting slow house building. It identified these severe structural problems crippling UK planning efforts, especially when you look at places like Germany and the Netherlands.
Okay, let's unpack those. What specific deficits were hobbling local authorities in the UK?
Well, the deficiencies were, I mean, they were glaring and systemic. They really focused on four critical areas at the local level. First, local authorities just lacked the necessary power.
Power to do what, exactly?
To assemble large areas of land quickly and to drive development strategically. Second, they lacked the crucial resources, you know, the financial independence to front load all that infrastructure investment. And third, there was a demonstrable lack of professional competence, the internal skills to actually execute these highly complex, multi-decade strategic plans.
And the fourth. That one always seemed to me to be the most easily solvable, but somehow the most persistent failure.
The fourth was the lack of knowledge of best practice from abroad. They argued that the UK's planning establishment had become, well, a bit insular. And while there might have been technical support available, it was pretty useless without the essential ingredient. The ambition to create better places, you know, the drive to overcome massive barriers, especially the need for adequate infrastructure.
Right.
Falk and Hall proposed a surprisingly simple, low-tech solution to this knowledge gap. They basically said, we need organized mandatory study tours. They believed local politicians and planning officials needed to be physically shown what a functional, successful new city extension looked like. Seeing is believing, right?
It's a powerful point. You can read 1,000 reports, but actually walking through a thriving, transit-oriented development like Freiburg must be instantly transformative. That realization led directly to their follow-up research, compiled in Good Cities, Better Lives in 2014. This is the ultimate playbook they put together, the key knowledge transfer moment for you, the listener. Let's dive into what specific lessons they transfer from Europe.
This is where we break down the toolkit. They systematically analyzed which country excelled at which element of urban creation. It provides these sort of modular solutions that the UK could adopt.
Okay, let's start with Germany. Beyond its general economic strength, what concrete mechanism did they offer for overcoming the biggest UK hurdle, land assembly?
Germany offered the best lessons for both strengthening the local economy and for tackling that crippling problem of land assembly. I mean, the UK system allows existing landowners to just hold out for these massive financial windfalls, and that often blocks necessary development.
Right.
Germany, and especially the example of Freiburg, showed how a local authority could step in proactively, assemble all these disparate plots of land, and coordinate infrastructure. It just reduces the time and the cost associated with wrangling all that fragmented ownership. They really provided a potential legal and financial model for the UK.
And what about France? When we talk about strategic long-term development, the French system seems almost legendary for its organization.
Oh, France was the undisputed masterclass for transport integration and its whole planning system. Falkenhall described the French system as acting like an escalator that smoothly links development planning with the necessary finance.
An escalator. I like that.
Yeah. And this coordination is achieved through specific legal instruments. The key tool they highlighted is the French concept of zones d'aménagement concertés, or ZSCs.
Okay. Tell us more about ZSCs. That sounds like a key legal insight we need to unpack here.
ZSCs are, they're essentially designated development zones. The local authority has the contractual and legal power to carry out or finance land acquisition, infrastructure works, and all the necessary equipment. They are absolutely essential for securing contractual agreements with all the stakeholders, which gives long-term confidence to private investors.
So everyone knows where they stand from day one.
Exactly. Instead of dealing with uncertainty, the developer knows the infrastructure will be there. And the public interest, things like affordable housing or parks, is contractually guaranteed right up front. It forces coordination.
That makes perfect sense. Of course, if you lack that professional competence and the powers we discussed, replicating a French ZAC system would be extremely difficult. But the goal is clear. Coordinated, legally binding planning. What about the Netherlands? They seem to have mastered delivering at a massive scale and quickly.
The Netherlands showed the power of proactive, highly structured spatial planning. Their Vinex policy, which, I mean, it delivered a staggering 95 urban extensions over just 10 years.
95. Wow.
It demonstrated two crucial elements. First, the importance of powerful public-private partnerships where risk and reward are actually shared. And second, the strategic use of state investment banks to fund advanced infrastructure. This ensures that development happens where it's strategically desired by the community, backed by infrastructure from day one, rather than just being dictated by where the land is cheapest.
So proactive planning, robust partnerships, and front-loaded finance.
No.
Okay. And finally, Scandinavia, which offered the best lessons for environment and resource conservation. That kind of completes the full circle, doesn't it? Economic, social, and environmental.
By creating this comprehensive toolkit, you know, economy from Germany, planning and transport from France, delivery and finance from the Netherlands, and that environmental focus from Scandinavia, they created the roadmap for the UK. But of course, none of it works without money.
Which brings us to the crucial element, funding. If you want to build a whole new social city or a major urban extension like the one proposed in the Uxester Garden City bid, how do you pay for the big, expensive stuff? The mass transit, the sewage systems, the major roads, without draining central government subsidy. The 2014 Smith Institute report was really clear on this. You need a new financial architecture.
This is perhaps the most challenging part, but it also offers the greatest return. The answer lies in importing Europe's financial models, and that starts with the investment bank concept.
Tell us about these state investment banks. What makes them so different from, say, a commercial bank or normal government lending?
Well, they strongly advocated for a model like France's Caisse de dépôt or the Dutch BNG. These are institutions often set up by local authorities and public utilities, and their mandate is long-term strategic investment, not short-term profit. They can lend at lower rates and for much longer periods, we're talking 30 or 40 years, specifically to front-load that infrastructure. The creation of the UK Infrastructure Bank showed that the concept was at least recognized.
So they act as strategic patient capital.
Exactly, and that investment has to be guided. They really stress that money must follow coordinated strategic frameworks, meaning a 40-year plan for housing, transport, and jobs, not just funding attractive but ultimately disconnected architectural master plans. Strategy has to come first.
And what's the core mechanism that actually generates the money for the services and infrastructure, the thing that stops us relying on the Treasury?
It's all about capturing the uplift in land values. This mechanism is absolutely core to their model. When a piece of farmland gets planning permission and is serviced with roads, water, and power, its value can increase tenfold or even more. The core funding mechanism is sharing that uplift in land values, and you tap that through local action plans.
But if that concept is so powerful, why does it so often fail in the UK? This is where the term hope value comes in, which seems to cripple the process.
That's the absolute crux of the financial failure. Hope value is the speculative, inflated price placed on unserviced land before planning permission is even granted. So imagine a speculator buys a patch of scrubland purely because they hope one day it will be developed and they'll get a massive windfall.
Right.
That speculation artificially inflates the price. So the land cost is already prohibitively high, crippling the ability of the public sector to capture the genuine uplift needed to pay for the infrastructure. You are, in essence, paying for the infrastructure twice.
So if the government has to buy land at that inflated hope value, there's just no money left to pay for the roads or the schools.
Precisely. And that's why Germany's ability to proactively assemble land at a fair rate was cited as so vital, it solves the hope value problem. Now, for a concrete example of successful land value capture, you just have to look at the new town of Ørestad in Copenhagen. They successfully funded their entire first metro line by sharing the land value uplift generated by all the surrounding development.
The infrastructure literally paid for itself.
Yes. And closer to home, Nottingham used charges on employer parking to help fund their local tram system. The funds exist. It's the legal and financial architecture to tap them that has been missing.
That reframes the entire financing conversation. Okay, let's pivot to connectivity and growth. The research touched on major political proposals, like George Osborne's Powerhouse for the North, and used it as a stepping stone to discuss smarter growth. What did they conclude about maximizing economic benefit through transport?
What's fascinating here is the absolute priority they gave to local connectivity over, say, intercity speed. They pointed out that Britain's second cities, places like Manchester, Leeds, Liverpool, are often geographically too small compared to their continental equivalents, like a Munich or a Hamburg, to truly exploit what they call agglomeration economies.
That's the benefits you get from having businesses and skilled talent all clustered together, right?
Exactly. For that to work, these cities need to work collaboratively, and people need to be able to move across the entire city region easily.
So the economic benefit of making it easier for someone to get from the Manchester suburbs to central Manchester or across the city region, that outweighs the benefit of simply making Manchester to London faster.
Absolutely. According to this analysis, funding has to prioritize improved local connectivity because that is what directly tackles the problem of low wages and low productivity across the region. You instantly increase the effective labor pool that's available to businesses.
And this brings us right back to the essence of the social city model.
It does. The Wolfson Prize winners, including Falk, they all agreed on three basic steps for smarter growth. One, upgrading local public transport to create better links. Two, assembling strategic sites around those new links. And three, growing sustainable urban extensions in that 10-kilometer area around a central hub. This cluster of connected, dense, green suburbs around a job center. Well, that's the ultimate realization of Howard's initial vision, just modernized for the 21st century.
And achieving that local connectivity, it requires significant investment in mass transit. What specific systems were championed?
Investment in serious mass transit systems is vital. We're talking trams, underground metros in the biggest cities, and particularly the concept of SwiftRail. SwiftRail means using existing suburban rail lines but turning them into highly frequent, inexpensive, and reliable services.
So like a tube map for the overground.
Pretty much. And this shift is crucial not just for economics, but for improving air quality, public health, cutting emissions, and making walking and cycling safer. And, as we established, improving connectivity raises adjacent property values, which then facilitates the funding mechanism through land value capture. It's a virtuous circle.
Okay, let's talk practical locations. Building new settlements inevitably faces political resistance, especially around dense areas. Where are the best opportunities identified in their research, particularly with this challenge of utilizing public land?
The opportunities, they often lie in the suburbs and on the edges of existing towns, places where densification can happen along existing transport corridors like railways and canals. And critically, these proposals maximize the use of publicly owned land, which sidesteps that hope value problem if the public sector is both the landowner and the master developer.
Was there a specific compelling example that they proposed?
Yes, the proposal for a new garden city at the publicly owned Northolt Airfield in West London. This site is strategically located. It's already served by three central line stations and major roads. That proposal illustrates the principle perfectly. Find publicly owned, well-connected land near existing hubs, and then use its value uplift to fund the necessary infrastructure for a new high-quality settlement. However, success really relies less on the specific location and more on the long-term view. Strategic progress depends on the simple ABC of continuity. Ambition, the vision for quality, brokerage, getting enough resources and partners on board, and above all, continuity. Planning has to span wider areas and longer timeframes, often decades, which is just anathema to short political cycles.
That long-term requirement really seems to be the biggest political challenge. How can planning be sped up and protected from political turnover if local government lacks the skills in that continuity?
To speed things up, two things must be harnessed to rebuild that core capacity. First, we need a cadre of capable people to be found and trained individuals with the necessary skills and, you know, public service values to take risks and unblock strategic opportunities. Second, leveraging digital intelligence. Modern technology makes it so much easier to identify the best locations, to map constraints like water, energy, and flood risk, and to progressively remove blockages without waiting for fragmented councils or expensive reports.
And if we connect this back to that French model of coordination, it sounds like the UK needs its utility and infrastructure providers, the big players in transport, water, and energy, to act as strategic partners, not just service providers.
Precisely. The UK needs to ensure investment programs for transport, water, and energy are aligned with development plans. France has notably done this very well. By aligning utility and infrastructure provision alongside the development planning, they maximize the impact of every public pound spent. It ensures the infrastructure is there when the first resident arrives, not 5 years later.
Okay, let's bring this all together then. The path to successful social cities requires importing these proven European strategic planning and financial mechanisms like state banks and land value capture. It means prioritizing local mass transit like Swift Rail and leveraging publicly owned land wherever possible.
The core takeaway is that success is entirely dependent on local authorities working collaboratively. You see it in structures like the Charter for Quality Growth adopted in Cambridgeshire. It's about achieving that elusive long-term continuity and vision and funding spanning multiple electoral cycles.
This analysis gives us a comprehensive roadmap, really, from diagnosis to financing to implementation, but it hinges on one critical final shift in how we evaluate things. The source material suggests that instead of using simple, restrictive cost-benefit analysis, which so often kills ambitious long-term projects before they start, projects should be evaluated against multiple criteria that include social and environmental benefits.
And that changes the entire calculation of what constitutes a successful project.
So for you, the listener, here's the thought to take away. How does shifting the measure of success away from just immediate costs and simple financial return to include social criteria like health, clean air, environmental resilience, and long-term economic stability? How does that fundamentally change which urban projects actually get built? If Orsted had only looked at the immediate costs of that metro line, would they have built it? Probably not. The multi-criteria evaluation allows us to value the social city, not just the spreadsheet. That's something to mull over until our next deep dive.